I mean, ultimately, we're looking for people with deeper stories than just I'm a fan of football or I play football. People always come with other elements to their personalities and their stories. We are, as you say, trying to find people with deeper ties into arts and culture and music and filmmaking and photography. And there's never one set way to find the right storyteller.
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name's Owen Connolly. Hope you're well. It is great to have you listening. Now, there's no one story of any sports event or community or culture. Our understanding of them really is forged out of multiple different perspectives and experiences. But to get to some of those points of view, those personal histories, you've got to give people the tools and the platform to share them. For the last decade or so, that's been the mission of GoalClick, a company that finds real people from around the world and helps them tell their stories through a sporting lens. Its storytellers have come from refugee camps in Sierra Leone, the mountains of Nepal, girls' football leagues in Pakistan and Iran, FIFA Women's World Cup teams, and even farther and wider than that. And it's worked with organisations right across the sports industry too, from NGOs and groups in the sport for good sector to major brands like Adidas and Expedia and rights holders, including CONCACAF and the Premier League, and as it moves into sports beyond football, the likes of Sail GP and England Golf. Our guest this time is the founder and CEO of GoalClick, Matthew Barrett. He talks about the journey the company's been on, including, notably, an embrace of more and different storytelling methods and techniques. He explains why GoalClick has made greater use of video and what it's learned through putting on a distinctive new run of live in-person events where non-performers share their formative sporting tales. And he talks a lot about the biggest moment of this year in sport, the FIFA World Cup in Canada, Mexico and the US. We discuss GoalClick's partnerships and plans for the summer, the stories it hopes to elevate and the ones that have proved harder to bring to light, navigating the logistical complexities of the tournament and making sense of the deep political sensitivities and controversies that surround it. Matt lays out how he hopes the stories of debutant countries will land and why he believes the expanded list of qualifiers will only add richness to the narrative mix. It's a fascinating chat about a fascinating approach to storytelling. I hope you get a lot out of it. If you're enjoying the podcast, as ever, whatever you can do to get more people in on it will be much appreciated. Subscribe, rate and review on your chosen platform. Like and share content you see on socials. Details for those accounts, of course, are in the show notes. We've got a lot more very cool stuff coming up. More interesting people with more ways of thinking about sport and stories. And this episode is no different. Here is Matthew Barrett. Would you say you're at the shuttle point between here and North America at this stage, when you're prepping for an extended presence on the ground at something like the World Cup?
Yeah, I plan at the moment to be there for the last 2.5 weeks of the tournament. I actually have a wedding in the Bay Area during the July 4th weekend, which is actually quite a good moment to go. And then I'm planning to base myself out of New York for the final 2 weeks of the tournament, with the ability to travel to other cities if needed. But it's been, and maybe we'll come on to this, it's been quite hard to work out where to be and when during this World Cup. You know, Russia was obvious. Base yourself in Moscow, shuttle back and forth from other cities. Qatar, I mean, there's only one place to be. and even other tournaments, Women's World Cup, it was so clearly Paris and Lyon and Australia kind of flowed all ultimately towards Sydney. So this one feels really hard to work out where the center of gravity is going to be for the sports industry and at what time. Yeah. So my sense is New York and go from there.
Yeah. I mean, this is definitely something we'll come on to, but it's very much like to an extent, I don't know if the penny's dropped yet. It's a continental World Cup. I mean, it's three massive countries.
Yeah.
And so many games and so much, you know, so much happening, which probably serves an organization like Goalclick pretty well. But on that point, you know, there'll be people listening to this who will be very familiar with you, and there will be people who very much won't be. So, you know, let's just set the terms. How would you introduce Goalclick to somebody in 2026?
I would say that Goalclick is a storytelling organization in sports. And I would say that we have a very specific methodology, which is completely focused on first-person perspective storytelling. So ultimately, our mission is to build deeper understanding of people and cultures through sports storytelling. How we do that is we find people with interesting stories in sport, and we guide them to capture their own life, team, community from their own perspective. So this is not travel. This is not sending in a crew or a photographer or a filmmaker or a journalist to tell someone's story. It's about helping them capture it themselves. So it's that combination of real, raw, first-person UGC style content, but shaped in a more coherent, curated narrative. So yeah, that's what we do. And we have spoken many times over the years. And when football has been our only sport, it's now our primary sport. We're working across many other sports, particularly rugby, golf, sailing, and various others. And again, you might have known Goalclick more as a photography and written word storytelling organization, but these days video is probably our primary format alongside the photography and written word. And we also are doing live spoken storytelling events, which you came to one in London. And so, yeah, that is where we get four or five people with inspiring stories. We train them for a month, and they then tell their personal story in front of a live audience for 7 to 10 minutes. And they are really, really, really good, cool. As hopefully you can attest. But yeah, that's the world of Goalclick at the moment.
Yeah, people always say brave when it comes to standing up in front of people like that. But, you know, people are really making themselves pretty vulnerable in that setting. I mean, we'll, I'm sure, find ways of exploring all of those concepts and you know, what you're hoping to do over the summer. But what was the genesis for the project in the first place? You know, you talked about it. It's kind of like a half step between user-generated content and something a little bit more journalist or storyteller-led. Like, how did you find that space in the first place?
Yeah, it's interesting. Even the word project, you know, we started off as, I'd say, less than a project, a hobby. and we moved from hobby to project to side hustle to second job to business, you know, and we are a thriving social business working with lots of big organizations in sport nowadays. But as you say, the genesis came from ultimately my own personal interest in sport, geopolitics, conflict, social issues, where all of those elements intersect. I studied history at university. I focused on sport, politics, and conflict in the 20th century, kind of the further I went along. And I knew that I was what I often call an idea in search of an execution. I knew that I wanted to tell stories about the world, with that entry point being sport, politics, culture. And in 2013, myself and my co-founder, Ed Jones, stumbled into this slightly crazy idea of sending disposable analog cameras to people all around the world to have them document their own life, team, community as they saw it. And that was very humble beginnings, sending one camera to Sierra Leone, to the National Amputee Football Association. We got back an incredible set of photos from the church minister and football coach of that team, Pastor Abraham Bangura, and really it snowballed from there. So that's my own personal origin moment. And yeah, Goalclick over those first few years we were just trying to find interesting people in interesting places. And that lent quite heavily at first on the world of sport for good and sport for social change and grassroots football. But it quickly expanded into fan culture and into athlete storytelling, particularly in the women's game. And so before we knew it, we were doing an exhibition in London, supported by Adidas in 2016, showing off all of the work we'd done so far, partnering with Adidas on a London-specific version. And that really set the model for everything that came next, which included me quitting my job and doing this full-time. But yeah, everything that is present in GoalClick now was present in those earliest couple of years between 2013 and 2016.
Yeah. What's the process that you go through in finding storytellers and then creating networks of storytellers, especially now that, as you say, it's gone from that sport for good origin to much broader briefs or a much broader range of briefs for a much different range of clients and partners?
I mean, ultimately, it has always been built on an organic growth, a natural growth of knowing good people in interesting places. We tend not to social media cast, we don't street cast, we peer-to-peer cast. And really that means getting to know people who are central to their communities all around the world, whether they're activists and founders in NGOs, whether they're fan group leaders, whether they're players or journalists or coaches. You know, we have just naturally, by working with people, by collaborating with people, by getting introduced to people over the last 12 years, this network has accidentally come into being. Let's be really honest. I didn't sit down on day one and go, I'm going to build a network of amazing people in the world of football and sport. But the more stories we told, the more work we did, the more projects we did, the deeper and deeper we go down the rabbit hole everywhere. Yeah. And so we're now at the point where if we have a project in Brazil, we know that we have probably 50 to 100 people who we've worked with, collaborated with, spoken with over the years who are our first port of call for saying, hey, we're looking for this kind of person in Brazil. Do you know anyone in your community? Who should we speak with? And really, you're never that many degrees of separation away from the people that are perfect for a particular project.
Yeah.
We still do get some inbound, you know, people wanting to be part of GoalClick and finding us and saying, hey, I'd like to be part of this. But I'd say now that accidental network has taken over. And so much so that we now get briefed sometimes just to find storytellers. You know, historically, it was all about the content that we produced. Now I'd say probably a quarter of our work is just finding stories for partners.
Yeah.
Because people know that we have such a strong network all over the world.
I'm guessing a decent chunk of that is not coming from football or whichever other sport it is. It's coming through maybe local arts groups or creatives in another space or community networks or what have you.
You'd be surprised how much connectivity there is. It's very rare that somebody's just a football person. None of us are, really. I mean, I wouldn't describe myself as just a sports person. I have many interests. I have many different communities that I'm part of. And so I think we often find that, I mean, ultimately, we're looking for people with deeper stories than just, I'm a fan of football or I play football. People always come with other elements to their personalities and their stories. So yeah, it's those people can be found in many, many different ways. And it's not just, we're not just looking for the craziest, most passionate football supporting group. We are, as you say, trying to find people with deeper ties into arts and culture and music and filmmaking and photography. And there's never one set way to find the right storyteller.
Yeah. You mentioned that change in form and media and the kind of gradual shift to video. Where's that come from? Was there ever a point where you said, we're going to stay in this lane? We like the aesthetic of disposable cameras. We like the kind of intimacy of somebody writing something for us. or were you just kind of what feels natural to people, or, you know, how's that been led, and also how does it change the kind of curation end of it for you guys?
Not sure I've ever admitted this on a podcast, but the plan in my mind has always been moving towards long form video.
Okay.
I think when I was first interested in this sector, in this topic, I always thought, surely this is a, you know, long form documentary series ultimately. And you know what? Maybe I'm just on a 20-year journey to get there. Video was always going to one day be part of what we did. We actually were experimenting with video as early as kind of 2018. We just took our time. I think with everything GoldClick have done, we've always taken our time to get something right first, so the foundations are strong to move on to the next. We didn't rush too fast out of football into other sports. We didn't rush too fast out of photography and written word into other formats. But to us, every format is in play. Audio is in play, live events in play, short form, long form videos in play, because it is ultimately about the method of letting someone tell their story, regardless of the format.
Yeah.
So we love that we started with analog disposable cameras, and it made us a little bit famous. It's still a really important part of what we do. And we love it. But I think that the biggest myth I always wanted to dispel was that we were a photography project. Mm. We're a storytelling project. We just happened to start with an execution that was photography, because it was simple, easy, accessible, equitable.
Yeah.
And was a brilliant place for us to begin our journey. Now, as you can see, we want to tell stories in as many different formats as possible. And, you know, we are always looking at what could our play in audio be, or what could our play in medium and long form content be, and what will our event world be. It was never about just being photography.
Yeah. Yeah. And I suppose the other thing that's changed, if we're talking about the last decade, is the accessibility of video, not just here in you know, Western Europe and North America, Southeast Asia,
everywhere,
but in developing places around the world, it's become much more of a kind of lingua franca that you can, you know, you have access to a phone that takes very powerful video and can be edited very simply and all the rest of it.
It's the one, you know, piece of equipment almost a big chunk of humanity shares, whether it's their own or access to a phone, is extremely, extremely common, way beyond access to a laptop. it is a great equalizer.
Yeah.
The smartphone in many senses. So I think there are trends that are in GoldClick's favor at the moment. Again, I'm not saying we wrote down a strategic business plan 12 years ago that would factor this development in, but we see, you know, that move to video as something we benefit from.
Yeah.
Because we can have our people capture content where they are, without the need for big production shoots and crews and expenses that come with that. Things keep moving in a direction that benefits GoldClick.
Yeah. And events, I suppose, is the other end of that, particularly in the last few years, that where you've had this sort of, and we'll come on to later, sort of cutting through the overwhelming tides of content that there are out there. But events offer a different way for people to experience those stories.
There's a craving for physical experiences, I think. And I think the sports industry has done a very bad job of creating events that feel exciting and enjoyable and different. I feel a real institutionalization of how events are created in the industry. And we are the only people in the sports industry, to our knowledge, that are doing live spoken storytelling in this way. I think we are the only people with our partners at Herd Storytelling, the only people who are doing this kind of storytelling full stop in the UK. So I've long despaired at industry events and panel talks and the default setting, there's room for imagination and creativity. And I think that we have a brilliant product, I guess, if you want to call it that, for allowing people to get that fix of real in-person contact. I mean, you were there at one of our events in London. Not a single person was on their phone. Everyone was completely dialed in and locked in to what the storytellers were saying. And there were some audience kind of participation elements as well, which I just think made it really stand out.
Now, which elements of that are you going to be bringing to the World Cup this summer? What are your kind of what's an overview of your plans for that, what, 6 weeks or so?
Well, obviously, we have to admit that we're speaking in early April right now because events may overtake us. But we are doing some projects around the World Cup. Our biggest partner right now is US Soccer, which is a series we have just launched. We're working with them, with their foundation, Soccer Forward, to tell the stories of 14 organizations that benefit from US soccer funding. So, youth clubs, grassroots teams, some big organizations in the world of soccer. And each one of those organizations has one storyteller ultimately telling their story, but the story of that wider community and that club. So that's a real brilliant stake in the ground for us. Like to say that, we are telling the story of grassroots football across the States ahead of the World Cup and during. We're also doing some work with the FA. Here in England, again at a grassroots community level, there is a hope that we bring some live storytelling events into fruition either in England or in the USA. We're not quite there yet, but that is the hope and aim. And now is the time where we expect those last minute briefs to fly in. In terms of GoalClick independently creating work that we are just funding ourselves, like we've done at previous tournaments. It's been harder, as you can well imagine, to align on what we think a unique and feasible angle is. We did a lot of work in Qatar. I think we did a lot of very, very good work in Qatar, working with people who live and work in that country, students, workers, coaches. And part of me thought that there could be a really interesting series in the USA ahead of this World Cup, focusing on workers, for instance. I think that those dreams died about 6 months ago, just with the ability to tell that kind of story. We also had some tentative conversations about refugee and indigenous communities in Canada. Didn't quite work out. So at the moment, we haven't really got that standout series that we want to kind of bring to fruition off our own back. To be honest, we've mainly done that around Women's World Cups in the past. Although we did do series in Russia and Qatar, which looked at the kind of broader culture of those football communities. But that was because I think they were very misunderstood. I think that no one really had a handle on what Qatari football culture and Russian football culture was at the time. Whereas I think we are actually quite saturated with knowing what football culture looks like in the host countries. So, that's what we're doing, what we're hoping to do, and what we're not doing. But if you'd have said to me a few years ago, you'll be working with probably the two biggest federations present at that World Cup, the USA and England, we'd have obviously been very, very happy to be working with them. But yeah, hopefully some more things will come in due course. We do have some brewing conversations around some of the smaller nations. And that has always been quite a strength for GoalClick. We did a project with CONCACAF 3 years ago around the Gold Cup, where we told stories of fans from Panama and Curaçao and Haiti, all of which are countries who are present this summer. We've had a good track record of working in countries like Jordan and Cabo Verde. Like, I personally am probably a minority. I'm a big supporter of the 48-team World Cup because over 220 nations try to qualify for World Cup, having 48 in the final tournament doesn't feel excessive to me. And it also creates wonderful moments for countries who have never qualified or who haven't qualified for a long time. I cannot see the downside of having those countries that I named qualify for this World Cup, especially in a country like America, who have such a, you know, rich diaspora of people from all around the world in that country already. So I would be disappointed if we didn't find a way to do something with some of those smaller qualifying nations. Conversations are ongoing. And hopefully that will come to fruition.
Yeah, ongoing as you'd expect at this point, given, you know, we're quite close to the last of those 48 teams having been confirmed. And I think that is something we'll come back to, but it does speak to the nature of this World Cup and the nature of every World Cup, really, which is that you've got sort of a master narrative kind of overarching over the whole tournament. And, you know, as successfully as people predict that or understand that going in, that will be one story that gets told. But then you've got all these disparate stories of each nation and each group of fans and individual players and, you know, whatever else, which kind of gives it that richness. And that's going to be really different this time with so many different teams, and also probably fewer people sort of following the tournament in its entirety because there's so much of it.
Good luck if you are.
Yeah, but unfortunately, it's not the tournament that maybe we hoped it would be, or it's not the vibe, shall we say, and the expectations are different from what maybe we would have hoped for a couple of years ago from this tournament. And, you know, as we're speaking, one of the host nations is at war with one of the qualifying teams, or has been certainly over the last few weeks. There's all sorts of other geopolitical tussles around this. And as I think you alluded to there, there's a kind of anxiety within the host nation about, you know, the safety of certain communities within that country. Like, how do you approach that? First of all, you're working with partners, you're working with people who kind of get up and get on with it a little bit. How do you navigate some of those controversies, first of all, just at the top level?
I mean, in this specific instance, you know, obviously we're working with organizations who are not government affiliated, which obviously means that takes discussion point out of the equation. Mm-hmm. Part of me says that every World Cup will always have this, because that's what's so interesting to me about football and major tournaments is the inherent politicalness of them.
Yeah.
This crazy falsehood that sport and politics can't meet when you're representing national teams with national flags and bring them all together and saying, play. So the World Cup will always reflect the political reality of what's going on around the world. And I know it feels right now that we're in the craziest time that there's ever been and it's the most political ever, but that isn't true.
Mm.
Every World Cup, almost in history, has had this simmering politicization. I don't need to like go into details, but you know, in the 30s and in the 60s and the 80s, I'd say it was even more political. So I think first of all, we just need to like actually step back and go, this is normal.
Mm.
That doesn't mean it's good or right, but it's just, this is what comes with a World Cup. If you work in football, this is what you have to work within. And if you don't have a clear point of view and a direction, you can't work in football with where the money is coming from into all parts of the game now. So I think what we do is we just have to be very focused on what kind of stories we can tell and how we can be a point of difference. We can't give a perspective on everything. We can't give a solution and give an opinion on everything. I think this is what we found in Qatar as well. You know, there was so much noise around, you know, Qatar is awful, or look how amazing Qatar's doing. But there was such a lack of airtime given to the people themselves from that country. Yeah. And so I think, again, the way we navigate it is by going storyteller first. And that is what we will always do with every project we do. And it allows us to work in within tricky political contexts.
Yeah.
Because our primary focus is to make sure that the people who live and work in that country where we can are the ones that have their voices platformed. And so, yeah, my short answer is by going storyteller first.
Yeah. And I suppose that's one aspect in which this World Cup is going to be different from the last two, is that, you know, while you may have taken the same approach there, those countries had historically different attitudes towards dissent and towards freedom of speech. For all the challenges that have existed at a corporate level in the US in the last year or so, that's still the case. So people are still free to kind of tell their own stories and offer their own perspectives on things. So I suppose
to an extent. There are people who can't do that now.
Yeah.
But I would agree, not on the scale potentially of Russia and Qatar.
I guess you're navigating a different set of sensitivities, because what you're talking about there is people who are worried about, particularly with, you know, some of the immigration policy that we're seeing, worried about surfacing, I suppose, and or having, you know, friends or family or loved ones kind of be surfaced which is a, you know, horrible situation. But but at the same time, you are able to give people a platform, and the communication infrastructure still exists to be able to give people a platform in that way. And there will be support around for some of those stories from other communities.
Yeah, look, we've actually always had this in many, many parts of the world. You know, I go back to when we have done stories from North Korea and Iran, and we don't claim to give the entire truth about a situation.
Yeah.
That is not what GoldClick is doing. That's not what we're for. Ultimately, we can only really work within the environment as it exists. We try to do our best within those environments, but there is a natural, because of our method, a natural self-censorship. By the way, we all self-censor the entire time. Just it's just degrees. I still think that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Even if people are, you know, even if it's not the complete story, I think even, you know, pockets of the story, even if we're not covering every single issue or every single kind of person, I think having something and having those stories told is still a net positive. So we'll never claim that we're telling the entire story of a country or World Cup. I think all we can do is, tell those pockets where we can.
Yeah, and what people choose to tell you is revealing in itself as well, right?
Not completely. I mean, look at the North Korea story that we did once upon a time. I mean, there is no way that is the complete truth about what's happening in North Korean football, but its very existence is interesting and tells us things. And it's different perspectives. You know, I look back at Qatar, and the majority of our storytellers were women. No one else was telling stories from a majority perspective of women around Qatar. And so, you know, was it the complete full picture of everything that was going on in Qatar? No. Was it different? And did it give different perspectives and make people have a slightly deeper understanding of what was going on with those people and in that culture? Yes. And so again, I think that everything we do around this World Cup and future World Cups and almost every project we do, it can never be complete. And as much as we want to tell stories from, you know, the margins, as we have done with many refugee and asylum seeker communities around the world, we can never like be completely complete. and you know, our aspirations maybe around this World Cup have maybe not been exactly what we wanted, but yeah, we approach the world as it is, not just what we hope it to be.
Yeah. How's that influencing your thoughts on the value of this sort of storyteller first approach coming into this tournament? You have those difficulties around the tournament, but you also have some of the other stuff that we talked about before, which is a little bit more quotidian kind of logistical challenges and stuff of all these teams, all these cities, all these, you know, different subcultures and stuff that will only be a kind of piece of the tapestry and a smaller one than mm-hmm. they would have been at previous tournaments just because of the sheer scale.
Yeah, I understand for many people that's a real problem and a challenge. For us, it's less so because of our method and the fact that we don't travel anywhere and we actually don't mind where people are. If anything, it serves our purpose better if people are really spread out, because then our method comes into its own. Like, we can be in 16 places at once, like we did with our CONCACAF project. You know, we were in 16 countries at once capturing content because it's the fans and the people capturing it, not goal click. So actually a spread out tournament logistics, if anything, plays into our favor. I think from a industry perspective and going out there to network and be at events and kind of see what's going on in the wider industry, that's where it's a bit harder for an organization, a business like Goal Click, to know exactly where to be and when. But from a storytelling perspective, if anything, it's kind of working in our favor.
Yeah. Do you think that's something that is getting lost a bit at this stage, the fact that there are three host nations? You know, do you think we're at risk? Obviously, we know the kind of force of gravity that there is, particularly the political story. And the US is hosting the glamour fixtures at the back end of the tournament. But, you know, is that something that you've been conscious of approaching this tournament, that you do have to try and recognize those other hosts and those other stories that might emerge in that way?
On a purely personal level, I kind of feel like the first week of the tournament will feel like a Mexican World Cup.
Yeah.
But I also think any time that the USA is a co-host with any other country, it's going to dominate. Commercially, media-wise, politically, I think it's crazy to think anything else. It's got the most games. It's got the big games. It's where everyone's going to be. You know, it wasn't set up as an equal three host tournament.
No.
So I don't see it as a huge issue. I do fear that the Canada and Mexico stories will maybe burn brightly for a little while, but then fade, and it will kind of be remembered as a US World Cup. But I don't think it doesn't keep me up at night.
But in terms of, thinking less about what your plans are for the tournament and more about some of the work you've done in the region with CONCACAF and around previous competitions, you know, how do you think those other stories will come out, and what are there parts of the World Cup experience that people may not be expecting, or, you know, and this could be in the US as much as it's in Canada and Mexico. You know, are there parts of the fan culture there that people maybe don't understand as well yet, or that are localized in ways that people maybe aren't familiar with?
I mean, it goes back to what I said earlier, that I think America is actually an incredible host on paper because it does have so many of the communities from around the world without the need for everyone to travel from that country to bring a flavor of that team's culture to America. So I would expect that we'll see quite a lot of that. I'm pretty sure the Cabo Verde community is very prominent around Boston, you know, for instance. So I'm sure that kind of story is going to come out, and everyone is seeking out these kind of stories right now. So I actually kind of think America's uniquely positioned to be able to kind of have a truly World Cup without the need for lots of fans to come in from overseas necessarily.
Yeah, you talked a little bit earlier about some of the the discussions you're having with. So is it Cabo Verde, Haiti?
Panama, Curaçao, Jordan.
That you've worked with in the past, and you, you know, how reactive can you be now over the next three months, really, we're talking about between now and when we're really in the thick of the tournament and when the tournament's happening, to be able to find some of these stories and represent them and so on.
Very reactive. Our network goes fairly deep within most countries. And we know we're 1 or 2 degrees of separation away from the kind of stories that we'd want to tell if the opportunity presented itself. We're in a little bit of wait and see right now. You know, it's where do you play your chips? Where do you put your limited resources and budgets into that you think will tell a different kind of story? Do we fund ourselves? Does someone pay for it? Always one of the first questions. But our method can be really, really quickly reactive. You know, we like to have a month preparation before someone captures a story, but we can also do it in 2 days in terms of preparation. And, you know, the content capture window could be a very short period of time. And then ultimately the whole thing can come together in a matter of, you know, a week or so. A lot of Goldkick storytelling is over a longer period of time, but there's also nothing to stop us leaping on top of a specific story in a specific moment because of how we work.
Yeah, and I guess there can be a longer tail for some of this stuff through the course of the year, less so for the in-person storytelling events. But is that something still that you'd hope, you know, while you're on the ground, if something hasn't yet presented itself, you'd still be able to pull that together? Or because that's a, you know, you've referred a couple of times to the event. I think it was at So London, the pop-up, women's sport pop-up last year, in the West End. That's not just a logistical project. That's not just the kind of, we got to get the people in the room. We got to have the staging and everything else. That's a real
training.
You know, those stories are worked on and thought through, and some details maybe teased out and some details maybe dragged out of the participants.
Yeah.
What goes into that and what are you learning about that? Because that's something where, as you said, you have a partner in that enterprise and it's something that's relatively new to you guys there. Yeah.
The live storytelling is definitely less reactive. So I'd say the video photography written word formats can be pretty reactive, pretty quick. But the live storytelling is definitely a more involved process. We need at least 3 or 4 weeks before an event to kind of truly train and prepare and make sure, you know, the event is what it needs to be. So yes, that is a much less reactive format because, you know, it's a big thing to get up and tell your story in a natural yet polished manner in front of a live audience.
These aren't necessarily artists or performers.
No. These are real people, people who have, you know, great stories and need to be trained and confidence built. And we work on their stories with them to make sure they're the best they can be. That is less of a reactive thing. That would need a lot more planning. But we are very, you know, we're very hopeful that we're going to be doing more and more of these events. Naturally, a tournament is a good moment for them, but they're pretty evergreen, I would say. But obviously, we're the kind of stories we're talking about with the countries that we mentioned before, that is less about a live situation and more kind of traditional Goldkick kind of storytelling.
Yeah, sure. What are you learning through that process of doing those live storytelling events?
People are not used to it at the moment. It takes education. And actually, similar to how we had to kind of educate people that we worked with for a long time about our first person method, and that it would feel different and it would, the process would be different. There's a lot of defaulting to certain way events are run and certain ways stories are told within events. And it can be quite hard for people to get their head around it until they see it and feel it actually. I mean, even sharing, you know, video content and examples online with people doesn't quite have the same impact as when someone's in the room and really feels it. And it's no surprise that the partners of GoldClick that are most interested in doing one of these events are people who were in the room at a previous event.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's something really tangible and emotional when someone really gets you with something that they say that is harder to replicate online. Still possible, but it's harder. And so I think we've had to learn that it's a bit of a slower process than we wanted it to be. and we just have to keep creating these events to show that the model works, which is a bit similar to what we did with GoldClick 10 years ago. We've got to do good work with good people to show others that it works. Because being the first to put your head above a parapet and say, we're going to do some live spoken storytelling around football, you know, take some confidence. And, you know, not necessarily a punt, but, you know, it's a step into the unknown for a lot of organizations who just haven't done this storytelling before. So that's the challenge.
Hmm. What's next for you guys? Is that, I mean, we're kind of running a little low on time here, but there's a couple of ways to kind of skin this. One is to think about the organizations that you might work with. You're kind of very much in the industry lane at the moment. You work rights holders, brands, and industry in the broadest term, because you also mm-hmm. work with kind of NGOs and parties like that, but you don't tend to do media partnerships in that way. Is that something that you'd think about being a kind of another way for people to kind of gather stories whose business is storytelling?
We are absolutely open to working with lots of new different types of partners. And, you know, we've had interesting conversations with media organizations over the years. We've worked with 90 Min. We have, you know, ongoing chats with media platforms to either collaborate or do work for them. You're right, though, the majority of our partnerships come from rights holders and brands. We've done really well at working with sports rights holders in both football and other sports. And we are, obviously, I mentioned US soccer and the FA. We work with Manchester City. We have historically worked, you know, with the Premier League. And outside of football, we're working with SailGP. From a sailing perspective, we work with a number of golf organizations. So continuing to grow into other sports through rights holders is important. The brand piece, we've been working this year with Vodafone. We have a project ongoing with Guinness. We're doing some work with some other beer brands. Historically, we've worked with many club sponsors. I still feel there's so much opportunity for GoldClick that we haven't taken advantage of yet. I think we're really still at the start of our growth trajectory. So yeah, for me, it's making sure that we keep doing good work. We keep having repeat business from some of these partners. That allows us then to do some of the more impactful series that we fund ourselves, and, you know, keep growing into other sports is definitely where we see big potential.
Yeah. And in terms of the execution and the things that can be brought to storytelling projects, are you going to have, your eyes open while you're out at the World Cup for different ideas? You're going to some quite cool places, you know, vibrant places with a lot of arts and culture around, lots of different things you could maybe infuse into what you're doing.
Always. Yeah, look, I think we know that we're not doing everything that we could possibly do. I think we identified the event piece as something that particularly frustrated us and wanted to come with a solution to it. Yeah, I mean, personally, I aim to be in the States and want to go to as many different activations, executions as possible to see if there is anything we're missing and we can be inspired by. I certainly, you know, never think that we're a finished article. We're going through a really interesting time right now, GoalClick. As we expanded our team, we need a bit of a refresh of identity, what we stand for, what we want to do. And I suspect GoalClick will feel a little bit different in a year's time as we go through that process. So right now I've actually been saying to my team, everything's on the table, actually. For the first time in a while for GoalClick, you know, traditional ways of doing things, you know, on the table, traditional ways of working, traditional formats, traditional things we do, everything's kind of up for discussion right now, especially as we come out of the World Cup. So that's quite an exciting time, I think, as we enter probably I'll call it our third life. You know, if first life was growing it from basically just being me and bringing on board, you know, initial partners and developing the concept. If life two was growing a small team, we're now seven people spread across the world, you know, starting to edge into other formats and sports, I think life three is, okay, how do we grow sustainably and move from being a business which was, you know, mostly four, five, six people into something which might be double that size? And that does change the nature of things.
Okay. Lots to look out for then through the World Cup and beyond. Three questions before I let you go that we ask every guest. The first is, do you have an origin story or something that sparked your own interest in sport?
Do you know what's weird that just came into my mind just then? I really remember the 1994 World Cup Panini sticker album. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. It must be what we've been speaking about, but I would have been seven at the time. I was obviously playing a lot of football, but that was the first major tournament I was truly invested in. I think, yeah. I remember 92 slightly, but 94 was the first time when I knew every player, every game, every stadium, wall chart, etc. And, you know, I think my natural disposition was to go, oh, I'm really interested in this country and what happens there and who these people are. That just really, I think it's quite topical given what we've just been speaking about, that World Cup was the first time that I went, whoa, there was like a lot going on outside of England. Even if I probably didn't realize it as a seven-year-old.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Jonathan Wilson, he's got kind of a landmark book about the World Cup out. Well, it came out in the autumn, but kind of ahead of this tournament. His thing was the Ladybird book of the 1982 World Cup, which, you know, erudite man such as himself, you'd expect nothing less. But that thing that we spent quite a lot of time talking about was, yeah, all the different dimensions that there are to a World Cup that go way beyond the football. And, you know, the discovery of new players and stuff is obviously always a part of it, although arguably less so these days. But definitely the discovery of different cultures and things like that when you're young is pretty central to it.
I remember my mind was blown that the name of Switzerland or Greece was not Switzerland or Greece. Like, it was Hellas or Helvetia. Like,
yeah.
And I actually, how strange is that I remember that? Like,
yeah.
22 years later. Like, I remember that moment going, what's Hellas?
Yeah.
And I think that natural curiosity was in me. You know, I'm the kind of kid who just like made flags of countries around the world. So, you know, there's a red line from that to GoalClick.
Perfect. Hate to break it to you, it was 32 years ago.
Oh God, it was 32 years ago.
What's your favorite piece of sports storytelling?
I really, really got into the wave of original footage documentaries that came maybe a decade ago with Fire in Babylon, with Senna. And I still think it had its moment, and I think they still stand out in my mind. I did really enjoy The Last Dance during the pandemic, for sure. But again, that's probably kind of a slightly similar thing.
Quite similar, yeah.
Those definitely stand out in my mind I was really sucked into them. Especially, I'm a cricket man. Actually, is my main sport. Even though we haven't spoken about that at all today. and so, Fire in Babylon for me is like really on the money of my kind of personal interest levels in sport outside of work.
Yeah, that's a great shout. And finally, what's a sports story you'd like to tell or see somebody else tell?
Well, look, I often have said that the one story in Gold Click that I'm yet to find, that I'd love to find, would be some kind of sport in the Antarctic.
Oh, wow.
Yet to find it. So if anyone's out there that knows a sports story connected to the Antarctic...
Some bored research scientists, maybe you've come up with something.
Something like that. I just think...
There is a book called Penguin Stop Play.
Yeah, I've read it.
Yeah. So, yeah. But you want the first person, the 2026 update.
Yeah, I do.
Of that.
Yeah. I think there's something fascinating about, you know, sport in those harsh conditions, either in the north or the south of this planet. So that's my personal mission, to find something like that. Look, I think the other answer is that, unfortunately, wherever there is conflict in the world, Gold Click want to be telling stories about the aftermath and the reconciliation and the rebuilding. And there's plenty of conflict going on in the world right now. So insert any country experiencing that at the moment. And, you know, we would want to ultimately long-term tell that, you know, Syria is a country right now that I feel is ready to have meaningful stories told from it again. You know, their football team's doing pretty well. You know, what is the system that is enabling that underneath, and how has it been affected over the last 15, 20 years? I think that's a country that I have my eye on at the moment.
Okay. Well, best of luck in both of those missions. They both sound worthy in different ways.
Antarctic and Syria, the obvious answers.
It's been a pleasure as always, Matt. And thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Outlines is an original production from 2640.